It's 1 o'clock, so let's start fairly promptly and punctually. And it's wonderful to actually see you all here today, which is great. My name is Alex Leftuk. I'll be your module coordinator for this fascinating module called Introduction to Journalism Studies, which I pretty much guarantee at this stage, even if you don't like all of it, you like certain bits of it, and it might sort of serve as a very good bedrock to other aspects that you'll be doing as you head into the second semester of your 6 semesters here at the University of Lincoln. I've changed this around a little bit today because some of you may recall we had a bit of a challenge with respect to computers on campus this morning, but that's okay, we can cope with that. But what I'm gonna actually do today is basically give you the opening lecture, which is gonna focus on newsreels. Most of my lectures will actually be recorded and I'll put them up as a podcast as well, so don't panic too much if you think, oh, what did he say, etc. You should be able to listen again to the process. And I'll effectively be sort of setting the scene. I'll then be talking more about the module in terms of the assessments, in terms of what we're looking for you to do in seminars. I see, I think, 2 seminar groups, and then IMCA and Sarnim actually take the other 2 in terms of the 4 seminar groups that we've actually got. So really this week, we're pretty much jumping straight into one of the key topics of this particular module. But again, we'll be explaining some of the sort of the backdrop to it, obviously in the seminar sessions in general. And broadly speaking, the lecture will be, as its name suggests, a standard sort of information delivery system. And then we'll hopefully talk more about that in terms of the seminar as well. Can anybody not hear me at present? Because I'm conscious in this room, I tend to project over there from that point of view. All clear? All sorted through? Good. Excellent. So let's start off with this phenomenon that you can see on screen there, the newsreel. Long before social media, long before television in many ways, as a mass media form, the newsreel was something which was beginning to emerge certainly over 100 years ago now to start serving as a way of disseminating news and almost beginning to, if not exactly replace, then certainly actually provide a bedrock to the print systems. There's a debate about whether we should actually have taken it all the way back to the first publications of print newspapers in Britain, which would have been the 1700s, or even further back to the days of Gutenberg and the printing press in the 15th century. But I thought, actually, we'll start off with something which is dealing with a visual medium, which is dealing with a mass medium, which also was a way in which people actually got their news. And again, there are issues with respect to what kind of news they were being presented with, how that was being provided. Anybody seen the movie 1917 as yet? Oh, okay. Well, go and see it. Or if you get a chance, go and see it. You know, certainly, 103 years ago, ways in which the scenarios of the Somme and the battles against the Germans and so on were being developed, one of the ways in which people were actually seeing that was through newsreel footage. Peter Jackson actually did a full updated version of that and colourised a lot of footage as well and developed a whole motion picture on the basis of that. So again, it's wrong to sort of start thinking, ah, yes, well, newsreels, oh, back in the day, they all moved very jerkily and it was very crude, etc. You could probably draw a parallel between where the visual media were with newsreels at the start of the 20th century in terms of what we've been through in terms of the 21st century with respect to social media. And again, I would heartily recommend that you go along to Jason Whittaker's talk on Thursday afternoon at 4:15 in the Cargill Lecture Theatre, in which he really looks at where we might be heading. Something else we kind of talk about, and he'll be, again, developing a lecture later on in this particular module, which talks about how information technology is impacting in terms of people's roles as narrators, as journalists, as people who are reporting the news, and so on. It's a fair statement to begin with to state that one of the most important developments of the 20th century was the growth of recreation and leisure. unlike previous centuries where people would actually be divided very much into the affluent landowners and gentry of society and the workers, what we saw in the 20th century and arguably towards the end of the 19th century was the beginning and the growth of middle class aspects in all Western countries from that point of view. And as society gradually became more transformed with respect to technology, and people moved from rural areas into the city environments and into urban environments, certainly we've got Lincoln, we've got Manchester, Sheffield, London clearly, Bristol, Liverpool, Edinburgh, Glasgow, and so on. Industrialization was very much at the fore. And the thing about industrialization is it's kind of trade-off. Yes, you don't have to necessarily work 7 days a week to keep basically eking out a living, etc., but it does give you more time for leisure and so on. And the media, as such, was striving to keep up with people's leisure time. Now, one of the key things that we'll find throughout this module, which is very critical in the understanding of it, is most of these media initiatives are driven by finance. They're driven by ways in which basically it's a good way of making money. And whether you're talking about things such as sport, which is a heck of a good way to actually drive finances and profit with respect to that, or indeed whether you're talking about magazines in general, clearly these are all ways of actually earning publishers a living. When I talk in a couple of weeks' time about the growth of the magazine market, the growth of the comic book industry, areas relating to that, we'll see how they very much were key aspects of how journalists would be employed, how indeed profits could be made, and so on and so forth. Again, we're seeing a slight switch in terms of where people are consuming their magazines these days, where online growth is taking place as well. But about 100 years ago, of all of the leisure activities which were expanding, probably one of the most successful was the cinema. The cinema, which had effectively started off very much as a crude way of projecting moving images, very much at the end of the 19th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, we're seeing those early scenarios of shock of seeing moving images on screen and so on. This, again, the relationship between where we are in terms of things like streaming and so on, this moving image was beginning to take part as something which people were keen to see. And as the cinema grew in popularity, inevitably journalists were looking for a way in which they could create a presence and get involved with cinema. Now, the other medium that's also developing at this time in the 1920s, is radio. Radio, which effectively really starts beginning to gather a hold on the public consciousness from 1922 onwards. And it was in 1922 when the British Broadcasting Company was first established. It didn't become the British Broadcasting Corporation until 1927. And again, the future of the BBC, we've just heard this week, of course, Tony Hall is stepping down and leaving his aspect of director generalship to somebody else to deal with. That's something else we'll talk about in seminars and so on. But what I want to actually look at from the point of view of mass media is not so much radio, because we'll come to that another time, but focusing on the newsreel. Newsreels which, just like radio, actually had a mass audience. Now, cinema, as I mentioned, was pretty well established in Britain by the end of the First World War. It was actually estimated that in 1917, so a year before the armistice was declared, half of the population of the country would go to the cinema at least once a week. That's a significant number. Half of the population of Britain would actually go to the cinema once a week. It was a relatively cheap night out. You purchased your tickets, you went to see the movie, you went to see the sort of the trailers that were actually there. It's fair to say that the quality of the experience, pretty much as now, tended to vary. Many of these early cinemas were little more than glorified parish halls. Films would be shown to the troops in France, and newsreel and propaganda films were common, certainly by 1918. Now, one of the technological challenges were obviously all of these films were silent. Sound was not basically incorporated in terms of cinema until the late 1920s and certainly the 1930s, where the talkies developed from that point of view. And obviously, silent cinema has its strengths as well as its weaknesses. But producers would make things such as captions, images. And what we actually get in these early newsreels, many of which are online, you can access britishpathé.com, you can see a whole range of newsreels from those particular times where they've been digitised, a heck of a good resource to look at. But they were probably arguably more like illustrated papers, like moving pictures, a bit like you kind of get in J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter, where you get the images moving on screen and so on. When the propaganda services were effectively overhauled to create what became the Ministry of Information, one of the key things that the government at the time wanted to do was to have a news division and a cinema division. So again, there were two clear critical things that were being looked for. And the Ministry of Information were keen to harness the cinema, not only for propaganda purposes, but also obviously to promote a kind of sense of Britishness. This thing that we see really argued within the BBC, the representation of what it means to be British. There were a range of full-length silent documentaries which were known as the Battle Series. They showed major engagements on the Western Front. Obviously tidied up for public consumption. You didn't have any of the shocking images that we would later see in Vietnam, for instance, in the 1960s, 1970s and so on. And more of the films and the newsreels themselves were concerned with images that ridiculed the enemy, i.e. the Germans, and obviously celebrated British success. The Ministry, in other words, carried the responsibility for providing the British public with news of the war. It would also make a number of anti-German cartoons, and it would make other films which would probably be best considered as being public information films, ways in which war savings could be promoted, ways in which ordinary people could help boost the economy, and so on. And these propaganda trailers would be distributed through commercial newsreel networks. And again, they'd be reaching massive audiences. Millions and millions of people would see the whole aspect. And certainly between the end of the First World War in 1918 and the beginning of the Second World War in 1939, 20-year period in which massive innovation developed. I've already mentioned one of those massive innovatory aspects, the insight of sound. Sound was introduced with respect to the jazz singer, other areas in 1930. It was complete pretty much by 1932. There were one or two issues. For instance, if this was taking part in the 1930s, I couldn't move away from the microphone, otherwise I'd actually sound as far as a long, long way away. And there were issues with respect to that, but ultimately there was still this synchronisation of sound and vision. That innovation, the usage of sound, meant that newsreels could also start covering material that wasn't just pictorial, because you could introduce a very critical aspect, which again, most of you will be familiar with now, almost so familiar it becomes invisible, but the role of the voiceover, the role of the signifier, the person who, back in the day, would be mostly male, admittedly, now changed, genders developed, etc., but would be basically setting the scene and almost inviting the viewer to think about this particular aspect and so on. In addition to that, you've got uses of things like music, uses of things such as stock footage which has been developed and borrowed from other areas and so on, and all of that would begin to create what we would now understand as montage. Talk a little bit, possibly today, certainly in seminars, about how televisual literacy, cinematic literacy, builds up and how you actually select shots and images and construct that. Let's look at some of the numbers. By 1939 in Britain, there were 5,000 cinemas. 5,000 cinemas by 1939. And some of those new purpose-built super cinemas, developed by Odeon, amongst others, they could actually seat up to 4,000 people. So you've got 4,000 people in, in a cinema, etc. 20 million tickets were being sold every week. So again, a lot of people are going to the movies. The price was pretty much that of a pint of beer. Sixpence, basically, was the cost of an average ticket to go and see a movie. And this is, of course, the stage where, by the 1930s, the Dream Factory, Hollywood, is producing masses and masses of product. You look at the big hits of 1939, Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, Technicolor marvels. You've got, obviously, the Busby Berkeley musicals. You've got the gangster films. You've got the westerns. You've got a range of sort of aspects which are actually there, a whole range of genre types. You've even got the Saturday morning matinees of the likes of Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers, who would later inspire, obviously, the likes of Spielberg and Lucas to develop Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and so on and so forth. So a lot of key areas are really being developed in these popular cultural history. A survey in Liverpool in 1937 found that 40% of all Liverpool people went to the cinema once a week, and another 25% went twice a week. So again, you'd repeat your whole thing. You wouldn't just be going to see one movie, you'd see two, and so on and so forth. In New York, a similar survey discovered that half the population went to the cinema each week. That equated in York to about 45,000 people all off to the cinema. In other words, what I'm getting to here is cinema is big business. Okay? It's something which is making large, substantial profits. And proprietors would inevitably work all sorts of techniques in order to get the audience in, to actually see the particular product that they'd be looking at, to actually look at whether the American-based newsreel companies like Paramount and Universal, Gaumont British, Movietone, Pathé, and so on and so forth. There'd be penny pictures, special discounted pictures, Saturday morning matinees and so on. I mean, the cinema is still here. It's still with us. People probably still go to the cinema. It's still obviously got issues to see, etc. It's become slightly more analogous, certainly in an era of online streaming, Netflix and so on and so forth, into an area where it's more of a special occasion. But this is basically where it's the only game in town. And certainly the typical programme, if you went to the cinema in Lincoln, for instance, 90 years ago, 80 years ago, would probably be in duration somewhere between 2.5 to 3 hours. Okay, so I mean, people say, oh, it's too long a movie, etc. Actually, it wouldn't just be one movie. You would normally have an A movie, an A-list movie, which was like the headline movie you'd go to see because you like the star that was actually in it, or the stars, or you like the story, or like the genre, and so on. And then you'd probably have a B movie as well. That would be the narrative. That would be the kind of story that it would be about. But then in addition to that, you would have newsreels. And newsreels, as you can see from the slide here, focus on news in brief. Go to the pictures and see, underline C, the world's news. How you're actually seeing that. That kind of notion of being able to see captured as reality. This whole thing that might be taking place in the far-flung areas of the empire. Because remember, at this time, pre-World War II, Britain still clearly had an empire. A third of the globe was pretty much administrated by Great Britain. It was all part and parcel of that whole sort of sequence that was actually there. So a lot of cultural diversity and images and impacts that went through that. You'd, in addition to newsreels, an A movie, a B movie, probably have a short film, maybe 4 or 5 minutes. And of course, something without which no cinema trip is surely complete, the trailers for what was coming next week or the week after and so on. Newsreels themselves would typically last around about 10 minutes. So you're looking pretty, because obviously there is that notion that if you've gone to see Clark Gable in his latest movie, or John Wayne, or Gene Harlow, or Charlie Chaplin, you know, you maybe don't want to actually spend time finding out the news. And the news might be boring, you might need to work through that. You know, there's no real need for that. So it's kind of kept short, but it's still a way of actually generating information and so on. And the five major companies that distributed newsreels, you can see them up there, basically on average would produce roughly 520 newsreels per annum. So it's basically 10 newsreels per week in terms of what's actually being produced. There would, in addition to that, be some weekend and special editions. So if they were focusing, for instance, on sport, they might have some footage of the FA Cup final, some footage of Wimbledon, some footage, you know, they might be sort of following through on aspects within that, but they also were not time-locking that footage. It wasn't news in terms of instantaneous news, but it was news of things that normally people might have read about in the newspapers, and this was the chance to actually see those stories come to life. Many of the producers of newsreels actually saw themselves primarily as producing newspapers on film. So that whole line of when you see how do editors get their title, why is it news editor, and why, what's the difference between a news editor in film and print, etc. Well, again, a lot of that language is appropriated from the role of originally print newspapers, but applying it to the medium of film, etc. There are about 2 million feet of newsreel availability in the British Archives, so quite a lot to work through there. But the question that we need to ask now is it all worthwhile? Is it, as one of the essay questions suggests for this module, is it a worthwhile, reliable source of history? Can we look back at the newsreels as being a valid source? Or is there a complete contrast with people who would define themselves as documentary filmmakers? People who, names again will be mentioning, such as John Grierson, Robert Flaherty, Albert Cavalcanti, who saw themselves very much as actually recreating reality to actually get a political message across as well. Well, we'll come to that in a few moments. But broadly speaking, in terms of what we see with newsreels, they're mostly to do with communication rather than historical documents. I've already alluded to how they were used as propaganda techniques and how they were being used within that whole process. But they also would effectively tell the public pretty much what they maybe already knew about events. You know, would they cover the abdication? You know, the last time we had an American divorcee screwing around with the British monarchy. Sorry, heavy sort of political point there. But in terms of where you're going with Wallace Simpson and Edward VIII, etc. Actually, no. They often would sort of avoid that mention at all because they'd be concerned about censorship and various other aspects within that. And generally, there was a feeling that the makers and the producers of newsreels pretty much felt that one of the reasons for their existence was to actually deal with boosting the nation's morale. And you don't necessarily boost the nation's morale by basically pointing out how traumatic it is going through the Depression, going through the rise of fascism, and so on and so forth. So maybe you're looking for more of an upbeat approach to the whole thing. So however dark and depressing the years between the wars might have been, the one thing you can guarantee when you look at newsreels, when you see the sort of messages that's coming across there, is that you've got a hearty, upbeat tone. Something which says, don't worry, keep calm, carry on, and so on. Now that's one of the reasons why many people still criticise newsreels, because they would feel that the British public should actually be allowed to see what was really happening in the slums of Glasgow, with all the poor urban conditions of other industrial area towns and so on. And they should be allowed to make up their own minds. And that film images could actually speak for themselves without a feel-good factor being injected in, constantly creeping into the content and the commentary. And it's a really interesting debate that has echoes in the present day with respect to, should you focus on good news, focus on the news, as how objective is the news, how balanced is it, how do you approach the whole thing? All of these kind of messages that are all depending on your particular choice of news consumption, you know, whether you go Fox News, whether you go BuzzFeed, whether you, whatever your sort of line there, these are the kind of issues that are at the heart of that. As I mentioned, by 1939, so the beginning of World War II, about half the population would be attending the cinema on a regular basis. And actually, because they probably weren't purchasing newspapers, they would be using the cinema as a news source. So the next question we need to ask is, which half of the population? And actually, the highest proportion of cinemas were in the north. Because clearly we didn't have HS2 then. We may never get HS2, whatever. But in terms of the programming, arguably most of the actual news that was being produced was aimed at what would be deemed to be the working class, because it was cheap to go. It was a cheap, entertaining area. Wasn't certainly as expensive as the theatre, and clearly this is a good, certainly in 1945, a good 8 or 9 years before television becomes a mass medium. I mean, television is around. Television has actually started off back in the 20s. In 1930, the British Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, took receipt as a gift from John Logie Baird of the first ever television set. And actually, if you look at how television developed, it was seen very much in the 20s and 30s as kind of the equivalent to Skype. It was like a one-to-one medium. I mean, in the broadcast thing, which evolved in the 1930s into how we now see television, kind of really didn't sort of come on board until the 30s and then the hiatus during the Second World War. But that, again, is another thing we'll talk about with respect to the BBC. Lower income groups would tend to go more often to the cinema than upper income groups, who would possibly go to the cinema, but they certainly would not be regulars. And the other factor about that from a sociological perspective is it's generally the lower working class who would be least likely to have read newspapers, or in many cases actually have access to radio. I mean, radio is a very popular medium, but again, that whole notion of being more interested in sport and so on, entertainment, was there. The bottom line that comes out of this is that the way in which people were consuming their news, this whole way of seeing the news unfold for them, being told what things are actually happening, is proving to be very popular and arguably very influential. So what are the constraints that these newsreel producers are actually faced with? Well, technology is still very much to the fore. The days of citizen journalists and mobile phones and Mojo and mobile journalism and cam phones, etc., are at least 80 years away. So in terms of what we've got here, actually getting a film crew to a particular event is quite a logistics exercise. Equally, as film is used and developed, film in itself is quite expensive. And so actually, you needed to select a range of topics that actually could withstand a period of time. They weren't time-locked. You didn't literally have to see it on the day it was produced, because it would be quite difficult. So looking back over, as I say, sporting events, you might know who'd actually won, but at the same time, the whole sense of liveness was taking away. Live broadcasting was something which was very much the domain of radio. And that's the way radio effectively sort of really developed, as being an on-the-spot live version of events and so on. It was also much more expensive for journalists and broadcasters or newsreel makers to effectively cover events than it was if you were a journalist working for a newspaper. You had to organise the coverage in advance. You had to effectively make sure that the story you were covering was worth the cost of transporting bulky sound equipment, bulky cameras, and personnel, and you certainly had to plan well in advance. You couldn't just turn up and hope for the best. You know, there were certain events that you know in terms of the news calendar that things will be happening, etc. But again, this is a period where you have to really sort of think about how viable is it to bring a newsreel to this. And there's also the other question, which is if, for instance, you put in cameras in the Jarrow March, or the general strike, or any kind of protest march, etc., maybe if there were cameras to play to, you might have civil disturbance. People might actually kind of react to the cameras, and suddenly, you know, the focus of the whole event changes markedly. Because remember, one of the key things about film and newsreels and documentaries is they provide you with, and they provide the viewer with, a window on the world. They provide you with the whole notion of a creative version of reality. Another aspect that's used to see how things are related and so on. In terms of the marketing, cinemas were owned by a range of competing individuals and competing franchises or chains and so on. The aims of the owners were quite blatantly commercial. They would put on what the customer wanted rather than try and take the line of influencing or educating. Now, it's interesting that at the same time, we come back to the BBC, Lord Reith, John Reith, the first Director General, coined the phrase to educate, inform and entertain, the role of the BBC, information, education, entertainment. And he was very much on a mission, again we'll see this later on in the module, to promote the BBC as something which was not just representing the best of Britain, but also to kind of pitch it at higher aspirational classes and so on and so forth. Newsreels, on the other hand, slightly more cheap and cheerful. They weren't necessarily interested in accuracy of news accounts, and they certainly weren't interested, as I've already said, in terms of their connection with propaganda, in any sense of balance in terms of their news reporting. What they were interested in was scoops and, ideally, speed of reporting. The pictures needed to be there to back up the voice. And actually, sometimes it didn't even matter if you were using the wrong pictures for the voice or using library footage and so on. As I mentioned, as well as news, newsreels would carry schedules of events. They'd cover sports, they'd cover parades, they'd cover speeches, they'd also cover the launches of ships, etc. I mean, this particular newsreel from 1962, again, kind of gives you the typical kind of content that you're likely to get. The RAF Cranwell, King Hussein, the RAF fighter there from that point of view, good cheer around Trafalgar Square Christmas tree, Father Christmas goes by in a helicopter, Christmas pudding eating contest, news from the continent, Deb's ball, automation in restaurant, baby chimp, hunting will go, main and end titles. In other words, what you're getting there is arguably something which wouldn't necessarily be out of place in the running order for your average calendar or Look North or other kind of magazine programme. And again, that's something to bear in mind, because when people say, what happened to the newsreels? Did they all go? No, arguably, with the onset of colour television and so on in the late 60s, they simply migrated their media form. So a lot of the sort of techniques that we see in terms of newsreels and the way in which packages are put together still kind of echo, but not in the notion of going to the cinema and actually viewing them there. There were a number of magazine items that were used in general when it came to news readings, etc. Ultimately, the managers of cinemas wanted entertainment. They also did not want to upset any of their patrons. You don't want to get a cinema which holds 4,000 people in and have about 2,000 upset or concerned about what they're seeing. So there's a sensitivity to what images are actually being shown. And so the industry becomes self-censoring. There are decisions that are actually made which are deemed to avoid certain issues, certain storylines. I've already given you one example in terms of the abdication in 1936, where rather than cover it at all, just thought, we'll just step away from that. Just don't mention it. And as a result of that, even you're looking at things, and we can see as records of this, that even the music that's being used in the background mustn't offend. So it's a case of don't offend at all costs. So you take a safe editorial solution. You go after the ordinary and you avoid anything that could be deemed to be sensational. As I said, this leads quite clearly to the notion of self-censoring your output. Now, it's probably fair to say that the editors of newsreels took their responsibilities very seriously, whether they were reporting in times of war, whether they were reporting in times of peace, etc. Certainly, as we've already identified, they had a captive audience. And generally, there was an acceptance that film reports would have more impact on their audience than newspaper reports. A picture is worth a thousand words. So if you look at all of these images, suddenly there's a whole stack of other messages and meanings that are coming through on that basis. And editors would meet regularly to decide how to handle any subjects that were deemed to be slightly controversial or touchy subjects. Usually they would decide not to cover them at all. So it's complete opposite to what you get within the documentary filmmakers, etc. So you've got this middle ground whereby the editors were not sure whether they had the kind of freedom of the press to print or argue or produce whatever they wanted to, or whether they would be censored like the stage and live entertainment was being censored at the time in terms of what could be said, etc. Certainly this middle ground that they took was very much designed not to actually attract censorship and not to have a government body set up to actually deal with what can and cannot be shown, etc. This is one of the reasons why we get notions of general taste. It's one of the reasons why arguably you get a very limited overview and a very myopic, short-sighted overview of what is actually being presented and seen in terms of newsreels, etc. How do you define average taste? As I've already mentioned, anything to do with politics or the monarchy was treated very, very carefully. And we mentioned when Edward VIII abdicated in 1936, all newsreel companies decided just not to report it at all. Again, interesting in terms of that. There was a vast range of stuff that would be avoided. Any suggestion of mixed race marriages, any suggestion of British men or women with ethnic people from other areas would be avoided. Anything that showed army officers in a bad light, don't touch it, step away from that. And certainly there was unease about the hunger marches that were taking place, and also, you know, what should be reported, what was reported, and so on. And all of this kind of boils down to one four-letter word, fear. Fear of the introduction of censorship, fear of offending the audience, and as a result of that, no controversies. So uncontroversial content. No views, mere statements of fact. Just the facts. And certainly no criticism of the government. That and the general tone that they actually adopted of cheerfulness and so on pretty much served them throughout the Second World War, when generally they were seen as pretty much hitting the right note, you know, in terms of the coverage that they actually had of plucky Britain standing up for itself and so on. They kind of seemed to get it right, and most contributors would say that that was something that actually allowed folk, if they actually wanted to take the risk of going to the cinema when there might be bombing on, etc., to see what was happening and so on. There were a number of people who also wanted to start unpicking the whole essence of the newsreel as well. They wanted to actually go into the thing in more detail. They wanted to actually hold discussion groups about what the audience had actually seen. There was a genuine concern, certainly in the 30s and 40s, that the speed of film that moved from story to story relentlessly, moving on and on and on, was far too fast to allow people to really digest what was going on. It wasn't like a newspaper. We talked about a newsreel being a moving newspaper. That might be seen as a somewhat simplistic argument, because what you're looking at in terms of lots of images is, you know, one image, another image, etc., etc. How do we pick up on those kind of things, etc.? There were concerns about the authority of the camera. When a camera is put in front of your good selves, or put in front of any individual object, it objectifies, it provides certain images, it kind of has an impact, inevitably, in terms of what's being seen. No matter whether you're taking for a cinema verite, a realistic sort of viewpoint, you've still got images within that. There is a sense as well from the audience that the camera doesn't lie. Of course it doesn't. How do you frame the camera? How do you put the shot? Where actually, as we said, it regularly did lie. Editors would, as I mentioned, use stock footage. They'd put in noddies, they'd add frowns or smiles later. There'd be post-editing, there'd be other ways in which things were constructed. And we were seeing here a clear and classic example of how the news in itself was being constructed and developed. Something which was completely at odds with the whole notion of the essence of the documentarians and so on, which I want to actually come to with this particular aspect here. Now, as we mentioned, in terms of newsreel companies, etc., using extensive film libraries, cutting and pasting film to actually get the message that they wanted to put together, combining live shots, stock shots, live sounds, stock sounds, etc. That is ultimately the essence of newsreel. In other words, it creates its own reality. It creates its own reality. And a number of press proprietors were very interested in terms of not only the kind of financial development within newsreels, but also how it could be developed itself. The owner of the Daily Telegraph at the time, Camrose, actually had extensive shares in Gaumont British. Lord Rothermere of the Daily Mail was very much involved as joint owner of British Movietone News. Lord Beaverbrook was connected to British Lion Films. So again, there's that kind of cross-ownership that's coming across within that. And as I mentioned, it wasn't really until television began to take over that newsreels slowly and surely began to fade away. So what about the chap that I've actually just put up there on the slide with the documentary film movement and John Grierson? Again, worthy certainly of a whole series in himself, but certainly one of the fathers of contemporary documentary filmmakers. Well, I think it's fair to say that documentarians viewed their role, although there were some similarities with respect to newsreels, but one of actually recapturing reality and celebrating the ordinary. There are a number of mass observation projects really using the medium of film to capture that period of life in the early decades of the 20th century for the first time that kind of provides us with images. I mean, the 20th century was by far, and still remains because we're only approaching the third decade of the 21st century, although I think we're heading up there, the most photographed, the most image-based century we've had in years, in recorded history, quite literally. And what you're getting with respect to the documentary film movement is, again, a representation of reality. Robert Flaherty, in 1923, was very keen to develop his, or capture, what he saw as the loss of the Native American, the Eskimo. And he developed this thing called Nanook of the North, who had very much in love with the romance, the noble savage, other cliches, which again, for good or ill, were being put together. And yet, he still ensured that because of the technology at the time, that many of the material that you see in Nanook of the North were artificially created in studios. So there is this argument in terms of what's being seen, how things are being developed, as Robert Flaherty with his family. There was still an artifice to how these things were constructed. And the sense that the documentarians were telling everything that was truth, that was verifiable, that was very much at the heart of these things, is again open to debate in terms of how we're developing them as well. Whether you're looking at Nanook of the North, or indeed other elements that come through. Robert Flaherty, as I say, was Canadian. He's very keen on developing his side of things there. John Grierson, educated in Scotland, and viewed very much as one of the forefathers of the modern documentary movement. There's an awful lot of work that Grierson does you can directly connect right the way through to Blue Planet, all of Richard Attenborough's material, and indeed arguably the same thing with respect to Chris Packham and other. Any documentary area will probably owe something to how the documentary is being developed. Grierson was somebody who had actually basically studied sociology. And he was keen on seeing how the social sciences could be used to actually open up and unpick and make a better world. And one of the key things that he wanted to do, arguably this was a similar kind of aim that the newsreel makers had, was to produce material that actually showed the world as it really was. Whether you were a coal miner working at the coal face, whether you were dealing with respect to propaganda, whether you were dealing to news reporting, whether you were also dealing with public information films and also representing what we're seeing in terms of activities that might range from the slums in Glasgow onwards. But this is the case of, as opposed to showing an unvarnished image of life in industrial areas and the challenges that are being faced with, what we're getting here is a line which is very much focused on getting the subjects of the film to tell their own story. and you see in documentaries very much more focus on, rather than trivializing or marginalizing or arguably caricaturing the kind of main subjects, in some instances they're actually allowed to tell their own story. Again, important in terms of what messages are coming out there, how things are developing, in an era where very much you have politically a separation between the haves and the have-nots. Arguably no change there, though. And an area I want to just begin to draw to a close at this stage is the kind of coalescence of both newsreels and documentaries. Because Grierson and Cavalcanti and other documentarians would often work for the government in terms of producing information films. In this particular case, the brand is quite simple. Eat more fish. What can you actually provide for people which is nutritious, which is hot, which is relatively cheap and inexpensive? Obviously, that well-worn phrase, fish and chips and so on. And these particular areas that we see there, as you can see, the Empire Marketing Board, term quite interesting, obviously British Empire from there, the General Post Office, and the Crown Film Unit, were all very much involved with the documentary work to start producing material, which would not be screened as newsreels because they were longer form than newsreels. And the areas in which they would actually be screened would probably not be cinemas, but they'd be in documentary clubs, areas from that point of view, again, prefiguring the onset of broadcast television and broadcast media, where obviously the documentary has become a clear and clear and essential part of the world in which we see it today. So, to summarise, we've looked at newsreels, we've looked at the popularity of newsreels, and we've just begun to unpick just some of the key things with respect to the documentary film movement. I'll talk more about that in terms of seminars and how things are going from that point of view, as will obviously Imke and Sanen. Next week, because one of your first assessments, which is coming up in about 5 weeks' time, is to actually select from the first 4 or 5 weeks a topic to do some short individual presentations on, I'll be actually dedicating some of this particular time in the session to hints and tips to actually get the perfect presentation. And we'll also continue with some more thoughts on documentary work, etc. Could you please make sure that you've signed the register, which started off here and probably is working its way through the whole system. Thank you for your time, and I'll see some of you later on this week.